sahana bhavatu,
sahanam bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavatitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
Everybody have a nice day. Seems good. You all came back very happy. So. Ready? When taking a new body, can it travel over continents, or is it often in and around the area where you used to live? Since having a child, on the way, I'm curious of who this little fellow was embodied before coming to us. That's a nice question. I don't think there's any rules like that I know of, though. Apparently, just from anecdotal evidence, often there is. Sometimes they are born in the same area, but that's just from anecdotal evidence when you're reading stories about people who are aware of their past lives, and see sometimes it's in a similar area, but I don't think there's any such rule at all. And also it could be that centuries have gone by before your last birth, you know, because the from the standpoint of kind of the more subtle plane, the whole time is very different. Like some of the stories that are Shastric stories that are told, or just cultural stories that are told, say, for instance, you're a married couple and your partner dies many, many years before you, maybe 20 years before you do, which is, you know, means you have 20 years, you have to go on living 20 years without your partner. So it's neither good or bad, whatever. But from this perspective of the family member who has passed away, before when you come to the kind of the other side, it could be just like a few minutes, whereas for you it could be 10 years or 20 years. So the time difference is so much, at least from all of the stories, the Puranic stories and the stories that are there in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata and just the things that are passed down. So Swamiji is even, in some of his satsangs and things, he's mentioned things like that, you know, that the time is very, very different. So so that was just kind of a segue into the time between your births could be, you know, centuries, or it could be minutes. It could be where there's just an immediate, you immediately take another birth, or there can be karmas to express in different realms. Because in from kind of the Eastern standpoint, not just India, but in the East in general, people who accept reincarnation, they also recognize what we call different lokas, different levels of reality that you can experience, that you can be born into and have an experience for a certain amount of time and then come back. And eventually you'll come back to what's called this bhuloka, which is kind of central, where you're actually accruing karma, gaining karma and exhausting karma, that type of thing. All of the lokas, you're exhausting karma. But loka means these different realms of reality. But it's only really in this loka where you're accruing karma, you know, where that kartritvam, that doership is there, and you're responsible for your choices and things like that. So you always end up here, but not necessarily immediately, and maybe immediately. So there's no such rules, you know, in terms of even time or location. So as far as I've been taught, you know, it's not my area of expertise by any means, but it does come up because we're all interested in these things. So these kind of questions come up with Swamiji and Satsang and things like that. So. One thing is that your little one is the perfect, you are the perfect couple for that little baby, because that's why he's with you. That's why. Otherwise, he would be with somebody else. So he's yours and you're his or hers. So remember that when you're with your parents. You know, this is just a little tangential, but it makes me think of all through the Shastra, and especially if you could look in the Type 3 Upanishad, it's very evident. Something very important in terms of Dharma is may you honor your father and mother. That goes throughout, you know, because they're your parents. It's because of them that you were born. And they're the ones that went through all of all that a parent has to go through to raise you. But it's much more than that. They are your parents, you know. And so even though we have difficult relationships, especially growing up, there's often many of us have difficult relationship with our parents, but it's something to be overcome, you know, because the bond is so much. You know, it's visceral, it's organic. So you think that you can get away from them, but you can't really. You can get away from them in terms of distance and that type of thing, but your heart is not free. Your heart can't really get away from them. And so you have to come to terms with them and your relationship with them. And I know that when I was older and kind of working out my relationship with my parents, what I realized, and I think is true for many of us, is that at least in my generation, for many of us, our parents were not really able to talk to us, or we weren't able to have a real relationship. And I do have friends and people who did have really, really deep communication and a real relationship with their parents. So it's not a given. But for many of us, there's very little relationship there, you know, where you're just talking about, you go home and you're talking about the weather, or your dad takes you all around the property to show what he's done with his gardening, that kind of stuff. And you know, you help your mom clean the house, and I used to lay on the bed with my mother when she was older, and we'd talk about finances because she loved accounting, you know. So we'd have to go through all of her finances and things and look at all of this, and she'd always balance everything to the penny. So, you know, but what I really realized as I was growing up and they were getting older and older is that at some point when you become an adult, it's not about you anymore, you know. It's really, you can't expect them to relate to you, you know, in the way that you would like, because often they don't even have a clue. They have no idea. You know, who you are, what you've been through, and what your generation is like. And, I mean, to have parents that are really can meet you on your level in this era is a punya. It's a great gift. That's not to be taken for granted, because that is often not the case. But that's okay, because it's often not the case. And they raised you, after all, and so you just try to make them happy, you know, and have conversations that they can relate to. Talk about things that are important to them, you know, and make them feel loved and so happy to have you as their child, you know. Because for the parents' side, because now, even though I don't have children, my brothers and sisters do, and so I know from them what it means, what every phone call means, when they come home to visit, what that means, you know, that they're remembered on their birthdays, all of these kind of things. These are huge, huge gifts, huge gifts. And then as children, you might just think, you know, it's my mom and dad, you know. So the Shastra itself has recognized this, how important it is, you know. You just do what you can and remember, you know, I'm just speaking from my own experience and of my siblings, you know, it's really not about us at some point. It's really about them. you know, and being able to listen to them and engage in conversations that they can engage in, you know. So I never had this thought before, but it seems so true. Because as a parent, for those of you who have little children now, look at what you're doing with your little child. You're not having adult conversations. It's, you know, like I saw with Nemo, you know, and then she'd go, you know. So you do that with your child for so many years, and then, you know, when it's you're an adult, then you're going to have to give back, you know, to be able to be with your family and with your parents in a way that they can relate to. It's a huge gift. It's just incredible. I think also when you have your own children or you experience people who have their own children, then you start to realize what a huge thing it is. So we just give what we can, you know. Doesn't mean we have to move in with them. They don't, I think they wouldn't like that. But they might. Anyway, that just, I don't know why, it was just an association. I thought I'd share it with you. These things are important. They're important because it's Dharma. It's important for your own shanti, you know, because you feel like you've done what you can, you know, to be a good child. Good child for them. Are there other paths that can be followed to achieve moksha and self-knowledge besides the study of Advaita Vedanta? i.e., will people who study other forms of spirituality eventually come to these studies instead? How does Vedanta taught by Pooja Swamiji differ from other forms of Vedanta, if any? Okay. Well, no, well, maybe I'll try to answer. There's some complexities in this question, so let me try to do something. One, at least I can answer one part of it, and maybe a lot of these topics will come up along the way because it's a complex question. There's a lot to say about it. First of all, this idea that Vedanta is the only way, you know, is prevalent. But it's prevalent in India also, but the context of that idea of Vedanta is the only way, you know, has to be understood within the context of the means of knowledge available to us as human beings. And so the Vedanta, the Vedas themselves, the Upanishads, are viewed as a certain type of a means of knowledge. So as the course goes on, for those of you who are staying longer term, we'll probably get much more into what we call the pramanas and the means of knowledge. But let me just briefly tell you that as a person in the world, you have available to you certain means of knowledge that we take for granted and utilize all of the time. Like, for instance, our sense perception. Sense perception gives us an immediate knowledge with sense objects that are sakshat, that they're directly perceivable by us. So right now, you are seeing me, I'm seeing you, right? That's because I have sense organs that can be immediately available to this experience. My sense organs, it's called, this particular means of knowledge is called pratyaksha. It means that my sense organs comes into immediate contact with the sense object and I gain knowledge in that way. I also have a type of pratyaksha, or this immediate perception, in terms of experiences that come into my mind. Like, for instance, I have an emotion. That's not a perception through my sense organs, but it's something that is directly known to me. Or I have a meditative experience. That experience is directly known to me. So with the use of my mind alone, or with my mind and sense organs, I have access to this immediate access to this world that is there within the scope of my sense organs. You understand? All of the other means of knowledge we have are actually an indirect means of knowledge that are dependent upon my sense perception. So, for instance, I have inference Inference is also called anumana in Sanskrit, inference. An inference, a stock inference that we use is, you know, I see smoke on the hill, therefore there's fire. But I'm not seeing the fire. I'm seeing the smoke. And so if it's actually smoke that I'm seeing, and that's true, then I can infer that there is fire because fire is the cause of smoke. And so even though it's an indirect knowledge, it is a knowledge, right? It's indirect, but it's still knowledge because there's an invariable relationship between the smoke and the fire. And there's other types of knowledge like that. Like, for instance, there's one called presumption or upalabdhi. It would be like, is it upalabdhi? Upalabdhi, yeah. Okay. It would be like this. If I wake up in the morning and it's soaking outside and it's sunny, right? It's soaking all over, I can presume that it rained last night because nothing else could bring about that condition. You know, maybe if we had huge sprinkler systems set up all around and I knew, oh, wow, what a good sprinkler system. but really, it's usually pretty pervasive when it rains out. So you just presume naturally. But all of these means of knowledge, like another one is if I realize, gee, there's not an elephant in the room, okay? There's no elephant in the room, okay? That's because it's not that I'm not gaining knowledge because of my eyes, what my eyes don't see, because my eyes don't see a million things right now. They just see what is there. But through a utilization of this other means of knowledge, from the fact of what is there, I can recognize that something is not there. But I'm only seeing what is there. I'm not seeing what is not there. But if I say, based upon what I'm seeing, is there an elephant in the room? I can say no. That's another means of knowledge. So this is in all of the different philosophies and of the world, this epistemology, how we know what we know has been widely, widely studied. And so in the Vedanta, what the Vedanta will say is all of the means of knowledge at my disposal that are dependent really upon sense perception. Because without sense perception or the recognition of different thought modifications in the mind, which is a type of pratyeksha, you know, I can't know. All of my means of knowledge then are very useful for all of the objects of knowledge that take place within duality, within the sphere of sense perception. See what I mean? So I can have a subject-object relationship with them. That's what my means of knowledge allow for me, a subject-object relationship. So then the question is, what means of knowledge do I have available to me to know myself? Because myself, the Atma, the self, is not an object of knowledge to have a subject-object relationship with. So how am I to have a knowledge, understand non-duality, you know, to recognize it, to see it, to understand it? With what means of knowledge? Because our means of knowledge keep us contained within duality. And so within the Indian landscape or the Indian culture, the Shabda Pramana, we have another Pramana called the Shabda Pramana, which is a means of knowledge that takes place through the use of words. We use the Shabda Pramana all the time through our textbooks, or if you ask somebody for directions, you know, you gain knowledge from other people. I just think if you had to start everything from scratch, I mean, we depend upon knowledge that is passed down to us and we learn from that. That's all indirect knowledge. But we can also gain direct knowledge, just even within duality, from the use of words. Like Swamiji used to always tell the story of one time he was going to Rishikesh, where his ashram is. He was taking a train. I think he was taking a train at that time from Bombay going up to Rishikesh to give a camp. And so he was sitting there in the train, and you know, I don't know if you've been to India or ridden on trains or anything in India, but Everybody's always really friendly and they want to know everything about you and they tell you. And they also, they tell you everything that they're doing also and who their family is, how many kids they are. So there's always a lot of conversation going on. And so this man was sitting right next to Swamiji and he was really happy and excited about, he was also going up to Rishikesh. And he says to Swamiji, I am going up to Rishikesh. I'm going to a camp that is being given by Swami Dayananda. You know, and he said, I've wanted to meet him for so long, and I'm really looking forward to it. You know, do you know him? Yeah. And so Swamiji kind of played along with this sort of for a while. Oh, really? And then he said to him, you know, I am that Swami. I am that Swamiji. He goes, oh, you know. Because then he recognized, but just in his experience of the person was not the, there was no the particular knowledge that he needed, right? So it was by through the use of words, you know, pointing to that, that the two things came together. And so from the standpoint of the Vedanta or the Upanishads, we're in a similar situation because I am with myself all the time, you know. So just like this man, he had the experience of Swamiji, he was talking to him, was looking at him, he was all very intimately present to him and all of that, but he had no idea that that's the Swami that he was looking for. And so like that, I am here always as the very present to every thought, every experience I have, all of it, I am the self of all of those experiences and I am have a subject-object relationship with them. I can differentiate myself from them, which I never do until I'm taught. But nevertheless, I am here, you know, and I am the one I'm looking for. I am here, but I'm looking for me, right? I'm looking for myself. But I'm looking for myself out in the world because even though I am here, I don't have knowledge. I'm only experiencing myself from the standpoint of the mind, which always enjoys me, the mind is always says, I'm a conscious being. Well, which it is. It's like the pot saying, I'm clay. You know, so I take myself to be the limited mind, looking for that self which is whole and complete and free, which I have experiences, glimpses of when I'm not tormented by my likes and dislikes. You know, and I just kind of relax for the moment, then everything, oh, I wish it was always like this. This is who I am. This is how it's supposed to be. And it goes away. But I have no means of knowledge at my disposal to hold up a mirror to myself, to differentiate my mind and my sense organs and this body and this world from me. And so the Upanishads are a means of knowledge. From the standpoint, from the Vedic standpoint, the Upanishads are a means of knowledge for the recognition to hold up a mirror to your own being. And they're always in the form of a dialogue between the teacher and the student, the guru and the sisha, where the guru, the sisha, the student approaches the teacher and asks in some form the who am I really question. You know, Am I a byproduct of this body? When this body dies, do I die? Or, you know, what is my nature? What happens to me after death? Is there anything that survives all of this change? You want to know because you know yourself as a conscious being, but you don't know you are that conscious being that you're looking for. You don't know that the actual nature of yourself, the ananda of yourself, because the ananda is always only being experienced in terms of shanta vrittis or peaceful, quiet thoughts in your mind. You know, then you feel, oh, you know, this is how it's supposed to be, and then it closes over on you, and oh no, and then you get a shanta vritti, and oh, this is how it's supposed to be, and it closes over. You don't recognize the one who is always shanti, your own being. So you need a means of knowledge for that, and that means of knowledge is not something born of the means of knowledge, human means of knowledge available to you as a human being. And so in India, the Vedanta, the Vedas, the Upanishads are viewed as what they call aparusheya. They don't come from, they're not man-made, they're not made from a person. They're something that, this knowledge is something intrinsic to Ishvara, to the creation itself. And just like all other laws of the creation, when it's time, when you become someone who needs this particular pramana, you need this means of knowledge because you need to know, because you've had, in a very real way, this who am I really question. And it's not just a passing question. Like when my mom said to me, I came back from India, I was kind of telling her about this all, you know, I was telling her about Vedanta, much more than she wanted to know. And she said, honey, I don't have these kind of problems. She didn't have the innocence. She doesn't have the who am I question, okay? And even if it, for most people you have some question like that, it's just fleeting. You know, it's fleeting. It comes, that's interesting, it goes away. Because you don't really care. You're busy. You have things to do and things that you want to achieve and all of that. So that's where you're, that's your drive. Your drive isn't, you don't have that introspection where you want to know really what's going on. Right? And so from the standpoint of the Upanishads, they will say that for a person who is a mumukshu, for a person who really has this question, not as just a fleeting curiosity, but for whom it's important, then for that person will come into contact with this knowledge. They will meet their teacher. Yeah. Just like, you know, the Rolling Stones song, you know, you get what you need. When you need, you get. You may not be exactly what you want, but it is what you need. You get what you need when you need it. And I think we kind of all experience that on so many levels. It's true. You get what you need. And what about when you need knowledge? You need to know yourself. Then there should be a means for that. If it's a benign creation, there should be a means for that, for you to know. And so from the within the Vedic culture, that means it's in the form of the Upanishads. So now, to what degree is how is that taught? How is that happening in other cultures? I don't know, because you would have to be within that culture to see in what form this knowledge is being taught, because it's not going to be a different knowledge. It can't be a different knowledge. It has to be the same knowledge taught in a different language, using different examples that are true to that culture or whatever, you know, to take you to the recognition of yourself, which is never going to be an object in the world, right? You're never going to be an object there that you're looking at. Like, oh, let me show you yourself. Here it is, right here. You know, everybody look and see, I can turn it all around and we can describe it and you can be staring at it. It's not going to be like that. Yourself is never going to be an object. It's going to be always you. And so whatever the tradition is, whatever means they have to bring about that realization, you know, that's going to exist in some form or another in the different traditions. That's what we would hope and what we would think. On the other hand, this is kind of interesting for people who have studied linguistics. If you study linguistics, you're really studying the migration of humanity from some much more contained spot, maybe in northern India or southern Russia. They're putting it in different places, that the origins where they're pinpointing different origins of humanity, and then they watch as the language changes, you know, the modification language goes through as there's this, human migration continues and ends up going around the whole world. And what you realize when you study this is there are kind of linguistic laws where you can see like all of the names of the gods, all of the names, all of relational nouns, the names of the deities, like, you know, like Vishnu, for example, you know, or Shiva. You'll see, or even Ganesha, or Garuda. You'll see that the names of these deities are moving around the globe, making linguistic changes. And also you'll see how they're being viewed differently in different cultures. Like one, I think it's Indra, and I can't remember all this clearly now, but in India, one of the devas, it's Indra or Vishnu or one of them, is looked upon as a devata. That same devata I believe it is in one of the Arab countries, and I don't remember which one. It's been too long ago since I studied all of this. It has the opposite meaning. You know, but it's the same. It has, linguistically, it is the same being, you know. And same all the patronymics, like bratra is brother, pitra is father. But you can see how the pha and the pa, pha has replaced pa, etc. And so there has been a lot of changes and modifications that have gone on in terms even of our belief systems over the many, many thousands of years. So how does that affect things also? Anyway, to be seen. But you can't say that Vedanta says it's the only way, because that's really not what it's saying. It's talking from within its culture, and it's talking about the Upanishads as being the only way for gaining this knowledge in reference to the other means of knowledge. So that's really important thing to understand, because the other means of knowledge can only have it, what we call epistemological limits. They can only give you knowledge within duality. You see, that's what they're good for. That's what they're for. But they can't give you knowledge of what is the substrate reality of duality. So that's the important, to me, the most important thing about that. So then it says, well, people who study other forms of spirituality eventually come to these studies instead. Once a person becomes a mamukshu, means where the question is correct, the who am I question, you know, is correct, and that you notice, that you recognize the bondage that is built in to the very nature of the creation. In other words, it's impossible to gain a kind of a lasting wholeness from any experience that you have, because every experience by nature is finite and coming and going. So that's impossible, even in terms of your body and your mind and your sense organs. They're always changing too. So say you found something that you really love and it's going to be here for the rest of your life. And that's fine maybe for a year or two, and then you think, oh my God, I'm stuck with this for the rest of my life. Just remember the flea markets, you know, and your garage sales and things like that. You know? You want things when you want them, and then all of a sudden you don't want them. You know. So there is no stability in terms of your relationship with any objectifiable object. You don't necessarily, sometimes you love it, sometimes you don't love it, sometimes you hate it, sometimes it's meaningless. There's nothing you can count on here in terms of feeling the same way about everything at all times. It's not true. And so you say, well, where is there some stability? Where can I say that all is well with me? Whether I have done what needs to be done, I'm a whole and complete person. How can I accomplish that? And then you recognize, well, you can't, really. Not if you're looking for it in terms of gaining things in the world, a combination of things to make you happy, or getting rid of things in order to make you happy. You know, it's not gonna, that doesn't work like that. And so when you understand that, and that question becomes important to you, then you will meet your teacher. And it just says you will meet your teacher so that you can gain this, so that you can gain this knowledge. So it doesn't say you'll meet your teacher, and you're only going to meet your teacher in India, and he's going to be in robes up in the Himalayas, and you'll take a nice trek up to the Himalayas, and then you will meet him. It doesn't say anything like that. It says you will come in contact with this knowledge. And so, and this knowledge, you know, I look at it like this. Say you have the law of gravity. Who discovered the law of gravity? Somebody. Okay. Who's a scientist around it? Somebody discovered the law of gravity. Okay. Huh? Newton? It's Newton's thing? Okay. I get them all confused at this point in my life. So. Okay, so then do we have to go to Newton and his followers to discover, to understand the law of gravity? The law of gravity is something that's understood all around the world, is taught all around the world, you know, in so many different ways, in so many different languages, to all students of the world. You know, it doesn't have to only be taught where it was originally discovered. You know, that's just not how it is. So all cultures in the world are teaching it. So they're teaching the truths that we've discovered. You know, and I think that Vedanta is the same way. But it can also be mistaught. You know? Because there's a lot of stuff going on out there that is not, you know, not really very grounded. But I'm not talking about all of the things that aren't grounded. I'm talking about that which is sincerely, legitimately there. And what the Shastra says is that if you are sincere in your question, in your need as a mumukshu, then that answer will be there because it's your birthright. As a human being, you know, it's meant for you to have when you're ready to have it. So, and I really believe that too. I think that's true. How does Vedanta taught by Pujya Swamiji differ from other forms of Vedanta, if any? Well, he was a very traditional teacher, so if there's other forms of Vedanta that vary from that, then they're kind of varying from the tradition, and there are all kinds of different ways that it's being taught, that from a traditional standpoint, I can feel bad about it, but I don't, because I feel that when a person really needs this knowledge and is ready for it, then they'll get a teacher who can teach them traditionally in a way that they can actually recognize and understand. Because otherwise, there are different things out there, like Vedanta becomes like a lecture. Then you kind of take notes and write the whole thing down, and then you go meditate to try to realize, you know, what the teacher is talking about. And actually, that's not what's going on. What's going on, really, is that at the time of teaching, as this pramana, this means of knowledge is being wielded, you know, you're here right now. Yourself is here. This world that we're experiencing is here. So there's something to recognize here and now. And so it's not about taking notes and memorizing the catechism of Vedanta. So if it's taught like that, and then you're supposed to go and meditate and try to experience what's being taught, then you're going to fall into that big trap that I was talking about the other day of how we know what we know by getting the thought modification of something objectified, and then we illumine that, and then we have knowledge of it. It's not going to work because you're already here. The self-experience is already here, so it has to just be revealed. The mind has to be directed to help you to see it. You know, and so Swamiji's teaching as a traditional teacher, and then he's teaching exactly in the same way, other than personality differences and their own capacity to teach and that kind of stuff. He's teaching what the other teachers teach. He used to say that to us. I remember, you know, in the early 70s, the first three-year course he taught, where he taught through all the Upanishads. Early on, in a few months of that course, he said, what I'm saying now, everything that I'm saying now, I'll be saying in 3 years. I'm not saying something that I'm going to have to take back. And not only that, everything that I see that I'm saying, you're going to see that in the Shastra. As we were learning Sanskrit and really going through all of the texts, you will see this. This isn't just me talking. You'll see all of this tradition as we go through all of these texts. And, you know, I thought, he's just saying that. He's being humble or something, you know. But I don't know what I thought. I just kind of didn't really understand. I liked it, what he was saying, and everything. I didn't really understand until we started going through these texts, right? And then I thought, there it is. Everything he says is there. You know, it's just totally assimilated by him, but it's there. It's there in the Sanskrit. It's there in the commentaries. It's there in the verses. So it's not... The teaching of Vedanta is not some person's teaching, you know. It's an assimilated knowledge from being exposed to the teaching and to the Shastra and the commentaries that then is given. You know? So I think I spent a lot of time on this question. So. Oh, do you create karma in the dream state? No, you don't. Thank goodness. No. In the dream state, it's just the exhaustion of karma. And interestingly enough, you know, when you're transmigrating as a jiva, transmigrating jiva, in the upper and lower lokas, states of experience, you're also not creating karma, you're experiencing karma. So it's just an exhaustion of karma, not a creation of karma. Not creating karma. It's only in this bhuloka, this state of experience, and the highest loka, the satyaloka, where that kartritvam, that doership is there, and that you're accruing karma as well as experiencing karma, yeah, from my understanding. Okay. When I experience my presence, which is indescribable, not something I can define, just isness, I notice that I see even that as an object. When you said in meditation, be the presence, I'm not sure my mind gets it. How do I work on that? Yeah. Well, let me just say a few things about that. Your own nature is in a way indescribable, and yet we still use words to describe it and point to it. Because you're there, and so these words that we use, like consciousness or your own being, your own amness, you know, your own known, the experience of knownness or being self-evident. If I was trying to describe something in the world, you'd have no idea probably what I was talking about. You know, but because you are that, as where you are using words to point the mind to that recognition. Okay? And then when we do the nididhyasana, which also happens kind of within the classes themselves, because there's certain enfoldment step by step, that step that we do, and if your mind is kind of following along, then it sees. And when you do meditation, also there's an enfoldment often. Right now we're doing a lot of inner child work and that type of thing. That's also experiential, because you're going into that relationship. So here the words are pointing to your own being. And you think that you're looking at yourself as an object. But that can be very, very misleading. Because the reason it's misleading is because you are, as being self-evident. When we say this word self-evident, it means that you don't need a means of knowledge to light you up, right? Like, you in fact, as conscious being, are the only thing that is self-evident. Because everything else requires you to have a thought modification, a vritti, an antakarana vritti, a thought modification that you gain, of some object that you're gaining through your sense organs that gives a thought modification in the mind, which is then known to you. But without that thought modification, you have no experience of it. You know, you require the thought modification in order to have an experience of whatever you're experiencing. And it can even be something that's not necessarily generated by sense perception. It can just be like a meditative state or an emotion or imagination. But that's a thought modification. It has to be there for it to be known. And so it requires pramana. It requires the use of the mind and the sense organs, or mind and or sense organs, in order for that experience to be there. Whereas I don't require that. I don't require the mind. I don't require the sense organs. I don't require any pramana or any means of knowledge to be known. Because I am the very knownness. I am the consciousness which illumines and is kind of the known. It gives its knownness, its self-evident nature to every thought modification I have. So yourself is self-evident. It doesn't require the universe at all. It's self-evident, self-shining, it's consciousness. And so now every thought you have, because of being mitya, because of not having any being apart from you, just when I say mitya, think of the clay pot. The pot is mitya. It has no distance. It has no existence away from the clay. So now if I say your mind is mitya, all right? We experience it. You know, it's multifaceted, all of these things, but it's still mithya. That means it has no being, no distance away from me. And I am self-evident, right? And so now when the vritti is there, the vritti is as though self-evident. The vritti is known. It's not self-evident in itself because it depends upon what is self-evident. But when the vritti, the thought modification is there, it is shining. It is as though self-evident, but when we analyze it, the self-evident nature that it's enjoying is me. If it were self-evident of its own accord when that thought travels on, then that's its self-evident nature would be traveling on and it would continue to be known. Right? Even though it's long gone, it's traveling around the world. it's not mine anymore, or it's a little me that's traveling around or whatever. That's not the situation. Its knownness depends upon me. So now, maybe this is a better way to understand this knownness of him being known. I am known because I am self-evident consciousness. I don't need anything to come and light me up. Right? I am my own experience. And so this self-evident experience of knownness, of me-ness, is what every vritti that you have, every thought modification that you have, enjoys when it is there. So now this thought modification becomes known. It becomes as though self-evident, self-shining. It's just that I am the self-evident being that it is enjoying. That's what it doesn't know. But that's why the pot doesn't know it either. The pot just says, I am the self-evident clay. You know, I am the clay. I am the clay, because it is. And so the mind thinks, you know, I am conscious being, because it is. But what it doesn't know is that it is, in a sense, because mithya has no other being. It has no independent order of reality. So the conscious being that it enjoys, it does enjoy. There is nothing else there. Take the clay out of the pot, there's nothing there. And take conscious existence, my being, away from the vritti, there's nothing there. I am what is there, actually. You know, so... So what? So anyway, the point being that the self-evident nature, you experience yourself as known, but you are known without a knower. But since you experience yourself as self-evident and known, you can assume that there's a knower. You can, you know, it's though you create a knower. There is no knower. There is only knownness, you know. But it seems like there's a knower because you are known. But there is no knower. And in fact, as we'll see, as probably we get a little deeper into this month, there is no experience of a knower at all. There's only the experience of known. And since you don't identify with what is known, then you assume that you're a knower. But actually, from going far out to what you perceive with your sense organs, to the perception, to the knownness of the objects of perception, to the knownness of the body, to the knownness, you know, of the sense organs, to the knownness of the mind, to the knownness of myself, try to find the knower. There is no knower. There's only known. But our language creates a knower-known dichotomy. But if you start looking for the knower, all you'll find is the known. That makes sense. Maybe we'll do a meditation on that and you'll see. What do you mean there's no knower? No, that's very disturbing. But there's never been a knower, so I wouldn't get too upset about it. Everything's fine. I am not sure my mind gets it. How do I work on that? You know, the mind keeps... The whole process of gaining knowledge is, it's really a beautiful process because you get it. Teaching will be taking place and you see it and you get it. But then some other thought comes in that kind of messes with it. So now you're not sure now. You don't really get it. And then that little doubt is taken care of, and oh, that's now I do see and I get it, you know. But then something else comes in and becomes clear, and now you really get it. And that keeps going on for some time. And you know what's interesting is even in the very first time that you get it, you really do get it. But it's not complete because there's other doubts and confusions that are coming in that kind of as though take that initial scene away from you because other doubts come and cloud it over. So as these doubts will be cleared up and then that clears up other things and then these things are cleared up. And so that initial getting it becomes, the context of it becomes much greater, much bigger, you know. And it's not completely kind of lost or covered by the other doubts that you're having. And so I think with knowledge, even though the self is just one non-dual, indivisible self, this body is complex, the world is complex, all the laws of dharma and karma are complex, all of my attachments are complex, you know, my likes and dislikes, my aspirations, everything from beginningless time that has made me into this limited being trying to become happy, that's all very well-rooted, very, very well-integrated. You know, like this body, mind, sense, organs, jiva is so well-integrated into my ajnanam. It's the integration born of pure, unadulterated ignorance, self-ignorance, which means that this is all very, very real. Self-ignorance doesn't cover me, but it causes me to take myself to be this body, mind, sense, organs, and to need to make my way and all of that. So that ignorance is highly integrated ignorance. My experience is highly integrated around that self-ignorance. And so now the teacher holds up kind of a mirror and you see, and let's remember I said the other day when I went from class, I would walk out the door in India from Swamiji's class, and I would be just this shining jnani. You know, just everything so beautiful, so clear. And I'd walk out the door and back into this jivatvam, this state of being just me, and that all kind of going away because of the integration of myself as this body, mind, sense organs in this dual world. So your mind, you have to be patient. You have to let your mind... It has a lot to work out. There's a lot of seeing that has to take place from a lot of different angles, you know, and every angle supports every other angle. So you figure, you probably have the experience that something becomes clear, and then it's a domino effect for all of these other things. Also like dominoes, you know, they also become clear, and then something else becomes clear. And then like a domino effect, all these other things become clear. So it's a very beautiful process. You know, it's very, very beautiful. You should just enjoy the ride. Because it's so sweet. It's such a sweet thing. And it keeps the beauty of it. When something's real or something's true, the universe can't negate it. It can only support it. You know, it will negate and crush, actually, what isn't true. Because it's not true. It'll just roll over it, you know. It'll eat it alive. But when something is true, everything supports it, you know, continually. I think that's true. That's true of truth, you know. Truth is very similar, very simple, once you know. And then the world all just starts making sense and everything starts working in light of that. Everything becomes understood in light of that, and it's a very beautiful process. It's kind of big relief, you know, for those who care. Remember, not everybody cares. It reminds me when I came back from India, because for me, you know, I wanted it so badly. I was really a raving mumukshu, you know, which I think is great. It was really beautiful. But I was really out there, I really had to know. And so I spent a long time in India, a long time with Swamiji, and I thought that it was time I had to go back for some type of visa reasons and whatnot. And so all my very good friends, you know, my college friends and everything, we had all been, you know, it was in the 60s, and it was kind of a hippie era. And so we all thought, you know, when one of us really gets it, when we really understand this, finds that treasure, Sutanka, and we find that treasure, promise we will all come, we will, each one, we will come back and tell everyone else all this. So I found the treasure. And so I couldn't wait to come back and tell everybody, tell my friends, because these were good friends, you know. And so we all got together, and I had been gone for several years, and so we all got together, and I still remember sitting around and sort of telling them of my experiences and telling them about Vedanta and Swamiji and all, everything. I still did everything, you know. And they were all... They're all like... And you know what was so so shocking? They did not care. They were not that interested. I mean, they loved me and everything. We were good friends, but this was an if for me. It was everything, you know. It was everything, you know. And for them, it really wasn't. And you know, after and so honestly, I just ended up really going my own way, and they went their own way, and it's because we didn't have that much in common anymore, you know. And they were doing other things, and other things were what really important to them, but this wasn't. You know? So it took me a while to learn that. I remember I was getting my master's degree at Cal in Sanskrit, and there was this one teacher. He was actually an Indian, but he. I don't know, he had some different type of cultural... So he used to say awful things about things that weren't really true and misunderstandings and, you know, and I would be... No! It's not like that. It's not... You know, kind of, sounds kind of like a missionary or something. Like a convert. It was like a wild convert. It took me a while just to settle down. Thank God. I was young, that's my excuse. I was young, so still young. When does the self and subtle body enter the self doesn't enter, the self is always there. Yeah, there's no entry because there's no place where it's not. So when does the self and the subtle body enter the physical body? During pregnancy, at birth, if during pregnancy, what month? Actually, that's a good, very good question, but different Upanishads say different things about when exactly the jiva enters. Some say it's at birth, some say it's like at the third month. I think there's two different Upanishads that are saying something different, so it's not something that, to my knowledge, that there's a clarity on, like the jiva enters at 3 months or the jiva enters at this, but they do accept that that subtle body does enter at some point. But how that exactly works, I don't think there's a clear, for what I know. Now maybe in some other shastras, like perhaps something like a yoga shastra or something like that, that type of knowledge might be there, but within the Upanishads that type of particular understanding. It's not really what we call the Tatpariya or the essence of the Upanishad, and so just what is for there from the Upanishads is just that the jiva enters and takes this body based upon the karma. But exactly at what point, that's not clear. But I actually wouldn't be surprised if that knowledge is there somewhere in some of the different shastras that are available. But I know I think it's at birth, one says, and then I'm not remember for sure. I think it maybe was the third month. I think it was in the Aitreya Upanishad, but I'm not sure. We'd have to really look into it. So I'm pretty sure about the vagueness in terms of the Upanishads, in terms of the Vedanta. But I know how particular, especially different types of yoga shastras are, so there might be something there. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. swasti prajapya paripalayam tam jnayena margena mahim maheshaha ko brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam kshobharahitah brahmanah santu nirbhayah om sarvesham svastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu sarvesham purnam bhavatu sarvesham mangalam bhavatu sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kashchit dukha bhag bhavet asato ma satkamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritam gamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnah purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnamevavashishyate om shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namah.